मशीन लगाऊंगा, इस साइड से आलू फटेगा, उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Hello everyone, welcome to this week's podcast. So the topics that I wanted to cover today would be one, Biden starting to bomb Syria and the relatively muted response to this act of aggression on the part of America, on the part of a quote-unquote progressive government. That's topic one. I'm just going to just touch upon it. Maybe I've already touched upon it. This is something which I had said before Biden came to power, that effectively the same things that Trump did in terms of foreign policy will be followed by the Biden government, because ultimately the Democrats, especially the part of the Democratic Party that Biden belongs to, which I would say the kind of the Hillary Biden nexus, which also included Obama to an extent, is very, very militarist. In terms of they're as much in the pockets of the quote-unquote defense, in industry defense complex as the worst of Republicans. So the centrist Democrats are going to be no different than many of the Republicans, which is exactly why somebody like Tulsi Gabbard was so vilified by somebody like Hillary Clinton, because the last thing they want is America to become non-interventionist. A non-interventionist America, which again was something that Trump was trying to push the country to. In that respect, was one of the very few things that Trump was progressive in terms of, he was very much an isolationist, so that America should not be spending a penny outside America. This is something which the centrist wing of the party is absolutely opposed to, despite the claims to the contrary, and the fact that Biden has quietly resumed bombing Syria, which is essentially they're bombing the Iranian rebels in Syria, effectively strengthening ISIS again, should be a cause for concern. But again, since it's a liberal government doing it, the outrage in terms of late night television is muted. It's not even a story. It's not being run anywhere. The focus is still on Trump and the Conservative Political Action Committee. And, you know, there was a gold statue of Trump. That's really what the news is. So even though Trump is no longer the president, he still dominates the airwaves, because just like Modi here in India, he is the person that people want to hear about, his friends and his enemies both. And this provides the Democratic spinmeisters the ideal cover to push their agenda. So two things that... a few of the things, let's say, that Biden had promised during his election run, which included loan waivers to a certain extent for student loans. He's already gone on record to saying that's not going to happen. He is also, one of the things that the progressive wing was trying to pass was a $15 minimum wage, which again has, I don't know if it's going to happen, but it's definitely does not have the blessings of Joe Biden, even though he was for it when he was running and he was trying to get the progressive wing of the party on his side. Because of course, anybody knows that just increasing the minimum wage is not going to solve the problem. It's just that businesses are just going to hire less. They're going to cut jobs. They're not going to... And you know, economics doesn't work like that. If you make it from $15 to $20 to $25, it's just that the salaries don't increase linearly. And people can promise anything they want during the campaign trail, but ultimately, once they come to power and they start getting into the pockets of lobbyists, they realize that the things like this are just not practically feasible. So we already have within almost just a month, perhaps, of Biden officially taking over power, many of the so-called progressive issues being reeled back. Of course, the wording is all there in terms of equity, in terms of his appointments, you know, the easy things they are going to do. But the more fundamental changes to the US system, it's very evident that Biden is not willing to either change the course of US foreign policy towards, quote unquote, a more progressive stance, or that he is willing to drastically change the way the government interferes in things like minimum wage. It's very evident that he's not going to do it, which is a bummer for the AOCs of the world, but hey, that's just the way politics works. Anyways, moving on, I think all of us were the third test match in Ahmedabad, you know, dominated the news in India. And no matter what you say, no matter how you want to spin it, and I know that, you know, once you name the stadium after Narendra Modi, you know, any criticism of the Ahmedabad pitch essentially becomes a criticism of the government and vice versa. I've seen that in terms of, you know, if you say something about Ahmedabad pitch now, the people who have angry replies are essentially the same people who would have angry replies if you said anything about Narendra Modi. But, you know, naming a stadium after Narendra Modi, let's come to that later. But let's first talk about the pitch. No matter how you cut it, honestly, any pitch in which the game finishes within 2 days, there's something wrong there. Okay, let's just get this out of the way. And it's wrong there not for any other reason other than the fact that Test cricket, in order for it to be commercially viable, it has to go on for 5 days. People who bought tickets on third, fourth, fifth day, if they get their tickets refunded, then that's not doing much good to Test cricket. If Test matches finish in two or three days, there's something to be said on that. So straight off the bat, it wasn't a great pitch. Now, was it an unfair pitch? These are two distinct things. There could be, it's a bad pitch in terms of it being not financially viable for a stadium to host a two-day game or a three-day game. That's one thing. But is this an unfair pitch? And the answer to that is definitely no. It's not an unfair pitch. The basic thing about Test cricket, which is why the word Test exists in its title, is that it is supposed to be an examination of your ability as a cricketer. And that's really what makes Test cricket so fascinating. The purpose of Test cricket isn't just to score a lot of runs or to hit fours and sixes. I mean, there are other forms of cricket whose main objective is that. Test cricket is a test of skill. It's a test of mental strength. It's a test of physical strength, you know, to be at your best for 5 days. It's a great physical test. I mean, I can't think of many sports which tax the human body in the way that Test cricket does, continuously for 5 days, 8 hours. So that's that. But the thing about a test is that a test can be easy or a test can be difficult. For those of you who are sat for the joint entrance exams, we know exactly what that means. And it's fair as long as you and your next neighbor are getting the same question paper. That's really what fairness is. So a test is supposed to be difficult. There's no doubt about that. Now, in some cases, the test pitch is difficult for bowlers. That's something which we are more acclimatized to. And in some cases, in most cases, the test pitches are biased towards batsmen. That's usually the case where you have like 350, 400, 500 scores in the first innings. Now, when the equations are turned around, when it's the other way around, there is an outcry. In this case, the outcry again, this is different because whenever the English or the Australians lose, it's always because the Indians are cheating. It's never because we suck. So this is really the cosmic background radiation of colonialism still. But putting aside the whining of England, so as I've said before, England are the worst losers, are like whiny losers, and Australians are whiny winners. So with England, the problem is they got a fair game. They got a fair game where, yes, the pitch was definitely challenging. Again, there is some kind of, I read on Twitter, of course, that, you know, most of the wickets were on straight deliveries. Or, you know, if the English batsman and the Indian batsman can't place straight deliveries. No, not really. the wickets may have fallen on straight deliveries, but it's fallen on straight deliveries because the ball is turning. So the batsman is expecting the ball to turn. When the ball doesn't turn, that's when the batsman gets out. It's not that the batsman is missing straight deliveries because they're drunk. That's not the reason that teams are getting dismissed for around 100. So that isn't the answer to this. The real reason why this is a fair pitch is that both teams, the pitch did not change character substantially during these 2 days. For me, that is a no. That is a more searching for the word here, but I think that's a more fair basis for fairness than what is being expected, that a fair pitch is something that produces 350 to 400 runs in the first innings. No, it's not. I would say it's a more unfair pitch that way, because when a pitch is great, and I've seen so many tests where essentially the side which wins the toss, they win the game, because either the ball is seeming on the first morning so much that, you know, team is like 5 wickets down for 50 runs and then the test match is as good as over, or the pitch is excellent to bat on for the first 2 days, 2.5 days. The first side comes in, scores 550, 600, declares. The second side starts batting. The pitch is still okay. They get to 100 for two. And then on the third or fourth day, the pitch absolutely crumbles and they follow on, or they lose the game by 10 wickets or something of the sort. That, I would say, is a much more unfair pitch, because over the 5 days, again, this is again a part of what makes test match so challenging, is that the character of the pitch itself keeps changing. But in this case, in the case of Ahmedabad, the character of the pitch didn't change. It was uniform throughout. So both the sides in both the innings batted on a pitch that did not change its character. As a matter of fact, if you look at the test, if you just look at the innings, the most emphatic batting happened on the fourth innings by India, where they didn't lose a wicket and they made like 55 or whatever it was, the runs they needed. And again, in the context of this game where sides were struggling to make 100, you know, that's quite a lot of runs for not losing one wicket on a fourth innings. So in terms of the pitch being bad or the pitch being something that should be reported to the ICC, that's the sore loser part of the English team talking. So that is, for me, you know, Michael Vaughan and all those people, I want to keep that to the side. So I have no problems with this pitch. There's another reason why I sometimes say that pitches are bad. If the bounce is uneven, if the ball is shooting, you know, at ankle height, and the next ball like bounces up and hits you on the elbow, then that pitch is unfair. Because on that pitch, there is no way a batsman can reasonably be expected to anticipate what the bounce is going to be. There is just too much variation that's not coming from the skill of the bowler, but is coming from the very nature of the pitch, which essentially makes the whole game a crapshoot. That is also a terrible pitch. The Ahmedabad pitch wasn't like that either. The bounce was fairly even throughout. It was just that there was an inordinate amount of spin, which is why the wickets fell to the balls which went straight, because the batsmen were mostly playing for exaggerated turn. But let's come to the bigger elephant in the room, which was the naming of the... Let's be clear what exactly happened. So the Ahmedabad Stadium, which, by the way, it's always had a very controversial pitch. I remember in 1983 when India played West Indies, which was when the time I really started following cricket. It actually had variable bounce in those days. So it was actually a far worse pitch in those days. But lest I be accused of blaming the Congress for everything, let's just keep 1983 to the side for now. And let's focus on what just happened. So besides the, you know, they took the Sardar Vallabhbhai Stadium and they renamed it Narendra Modi Stadium. Let's name, there's no doubt about it. They did rename the Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel Stadium to Narendra Modi Stadium. And then they made the entire sports complex, they named it after Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel, which no matter how you slice it, I mean, the stadium was renamed. And And of course, for me, this is, as somebody who wants to stand by principles, for somebody who's been so critical of the Gandhi family for basically naming everything that they could after anybody who had their last name, this was, you know, the same exact same thing. But of course, the right wing had to support this. And some didn't, actually, but many of them did, because, of course, you know, what does, you know, principles don't matter. It's the person who matters. It's the context which matters. So for I saw different kinds of logic. So one logic was that by doing this, Narendra Modi wanted to focus attention on the number of stadiums that are named after Gandhi. What a masterstroke. Well, you know what? He could have done it without calling the biggest stadium of the world, naming it after himself. So there is no reason why somebody who is in power, and this is important, it's not that if, you know, once Narendra Modi is no longer the prime minister or has passed away, that you can't name something about after a politician. It happens all over the world, and it will happen for Narendra Modi also. There is no doubt about that. But Narendra Modi's, you know, this normally does not happen. Even in the case of Congress, there's a distinction between Nehru giving himself the Bharat Ratna, because the Bharat Ratna at that point of time could not be given posthumously. They changed it later on, of course, because of political reasons. But that was why, you know, in that very limited context, all of them took it while they were alive. But at least they did not start naming stadiums and universities as long as they were living. So there is a line that has to be drawn. Of course, we know that stuff gets named after politicians. And again, in this case, they already had named it after Vallabhbhai Patel. Why did they need to rename it? If they wanted to put another right-wing politician name, sure, name it after Atal Bihari Vajpayee. Call it the Atal Bihari Vajpayee Sports Complex. You know, call it Deen Dayal Upadhyay. You know, nobody's asking you to name it after, you know, the Gandhi Nehru Congress or anybody that they considered to be opposite to their ideological line. Nobody's asking that, but at least name it for somebody who's no longer alive. But no, they had to, the prime minister who's currently prime minister has to name it after himself. And that, I think, is terrible, because this is really where, when Modi is saying that he wants a Congress Mukt Bharat, at least some of us want to think of it as, what he's basically saying is we want to have an India where the culture that the Congress is associated with is no longer there. But in this case, it's just literally that he just doesn't want the Congress Party. That's all. He's perfectly fine with Congress Party renaming itself, because this is one of the foundations of what Congressism is, which is to essentially memorialize them in public infrastructure. This is one of the things that they have used as a way of persisting their dynasty, that their dynasty is always in people's mind space, because goddamn everything is named after them. Now, has there been cases of, you know, stadiums named after or anything named after living? Yeah, sure, there's the Gaddafi Stadium. At least Gaddafi paid for it in that case. But again, do we really want our prime minister to be at the same level of Muammar Gaddafi? We don't, right? So for anybody who's consistent, who wants to be consistent in principles, and who has always been irritated, angered, and laughed at the Gandhi family's propensity for naming pretty much everything after themselves. I saw a list that was circulating about on like 17 things that were named after, you know, the Gandhis. And what I was surprised, of course, this was being circulated by BJP leaning Facebook pages, was that they totally missed that things named after Sanjay Gandhi also. Now, I don't know whether they missed it because it was an oversight on their part or because Varun Gandhi is a part of BJP. I don't know what it was, but this just goes to show that, you know, that truly that there is no consistency of principle here. You know, naming something after yourself when you are absolutely in power and effectively the most powerful person in the country, this is something which should be left for tin pot dictatorships. And in India, if you cannot criticize that while being critical of the Gandhi family and of Mayawati, then I have to call you out on the fact that you're also not consistent with principles. All that you really care for is the context. If it is somebody who you like, then everything about your principles is changeable. And you can always find some kind of bizarre logic to justify. In this case, I think nothing more bizarre than this is a master move by Modi to focus attention on the gazillion number of things that have been named after Gandhi. I mean, if Modi wants change all of them, I would be 100% in support of this government if it decides to take everything that has been named after the Gandhi and Gandhis and Nehrus, and, you know, keep few, keep Jawaharlal Nehru University after Jawaharlal Nehru, because it's like really kind of crystallizes Jawaharlal Nehru's, the university's culture basically crystallizes what Jawaharlal Nehru stood for in many ways. So maybe that's fine. But, you know, Rajiv Gandhi Khel Ratna, he's got nothing to do with Khel. So name it, you know, make it work. You know, name it after somebody who's, you know, passed on. Take somebody, Dhyan Chand, you know, have somebody, not from cricket, ideally. But and even if somebody's living in this case, that person isn't currently in power. So, you know, you want to call it Vishwanathan Anand, Khel Ratna, go ahead. But if you want a Congress Mukt Bharat, if Modi is serious about Congress Mukt Bharat, then the first thing that, you know, one of the things he has to do is to get rid of the culture of what Congressism is. And I'm personally totally against that culture. And that culture is this naming things after oneself, which is a very, very royal aristocratic thing to do, where you name mahals after yourself. This is a very, you know, very Mughal, very, very old world royal thing to do. And this is, and the Nehru family, as we all know, is essentially considers themselves to be the royal family of India. So if a Congress Mukt Bharat for me is an India where we take a stance against that culture of entitlement and privilege. And in this case, Modi has the privilege. He is the prime minister. He is the most powerful person in the country. And there is no reason why, while he's alive and while he's the prime minister, that the largest stadium in the world should be named after him. I cannot find any justification for this. Okay. So moving on to, and we've had a lot of politics in the last few episodes. I mean, we had IPL last time. So, by the way, the Bengal elections are on, and I'll possibly do a show on the Bengal elections, but there's one thing which I personally, as a Bengali, find it difficult to understand nowadays, and maybe it's because Bengal has changed a lot since I left, but this inordinate fascination with movie stars, and, you know, we had like something like very similar to the IPL auctions recently. It almost was like the IPL auctions where movie stars and cricket stars, and you have to understand that in the firmament of cricket gods, where Bengal is, you know, Bengal's industrial progress and Bengal's, you know, record of producing cricketers is roughly the same. So we had like Manoj Tiwari going over to Trinamool Congress. We had Ashok Dinda, the legend, moving over to BJP, which means that there's now a substantial amount of people online who can no longer make fun of Dinda anymore. And with respect to movie stars, Mamata Banerjee's government has always made a play for movie stars, whether it be Munmun Sen, Mimi Chakravarti, Tapas Paul. You know, it's been a galaxy of, you know, Bengali movie stars, many of them very established, many of them just barely establishing themselves, like Nusrat Jahan, and, you know, I would hardly call her a movie star. And just like starting off, even Mimi Chakravarti, but, you know, they have all been made MPs. And there are some people, like, for instance, like Rupa Ganguly and Lockett Chatterjee, who've at least done the street protests and have really done it. I mean, they're movie stars also. I mean, again, Rupa Ganguly, but Lockett Chatterjee, I would definitely not call a movie star, but whatever, they're in the movie industry. So there seems to be this huge thing in Bengal nowadays for people, and I forgot Shatabdi Rai also. So I I cannot fathom this. And I just don't think it kind of, it doesn't tally with Bengal's pride of being intellectuals. This fascination for not even movie stars, because I can't think of, let's say, Soumitra Chatterjee or Uttam Kumar or Supriya Devi or Suchitra Sen, you know, being involved in Bengal politics, or anybody would have taken them seriously also. I mean, Soumitra Chatterjee was a lifelong, you know, Communist Party activist. But he was never somebody who was in the running. I mean, nobody, there was never like Jyoti Basu going to Soumitra Chatterjee's house and saying, no, I want you to stand as an MP. I mean, nobody did any of that. So politics was essentially something which was, you worked your way up the political chain. But you have a lot of people who, in Bengal politics nowadays, who are just being airlifted for essentially as influencers and nothing more. So this influencer base, I think more than movie star, I think a better word to use for them would be influencers. And Dinda is an influencer. And I'm saying that the bar isn't particularly high here. So this propensity, and I'm seeing this from both the BJP as well as Trinamool, because they're really the only two games in town at this point of time. But seeing them like, I mean, I don't know where this is going to stop. It's like an IPL auction. Manoj Tiwari to BJP, within half an hour, there is Ashok Dinda, you know, Ashok Dinda goes over to BJP and Manoj Tiwari goes over to Trinamool. It's so confusing now. There's one, BJP has one Manoj Tiwari, Trinamool has another Manoj Tiwari. Oh, God. There's now need to have like a Java namespace kind of thing where you have BJP dot Manoj Tiwari, Trinamool dot Manoj Tiwari. So this is an interesting thing about Bengal elections. But what I wanted to talk about, whatever amount of time was, and I tweeted about this, was this 7 or 8 phase election in Bengal, which, by the way, is a great idea. And it's very obvious why Trinamool Congress doesn't like this, because Bengal is one of the states in which elections have had a very stormy history. And it's very good that. And Mamata Banerjee herself used to, at one point of time, be extremely vocal about election shenanigans in Bengal. Now, of course, since the shoe is on the other foot, she wants to pretend as if that, you know, nothing like rigging or nothing like booth. Nowadays, you can't do booth capturing, but you can definitely do voter intimidation outside the polling booth. You can basically follow what in CPM times used to be called scientific rigging. This is again one of the peculiar things about Marxists, is they, just like they consider Marxism to be a scientific theory, they create theories, because ultimately the Marxists are, you know, they at least like to think of themselves as academicians. So they used to call it scientific rigging during the CPM times, which was essentially Gundaism, in the bad sense, not the good Gunda as in the movie sense. But it had this aspect of, you know, non-violent intimidation. Like one of the classic examples of their scientific rigging during the CPM times, which I'm pretty sure is followed even today, is that if you have like for instance, the CPM knew that some of the posh localities in Calcutta were not going to vote for them. So what they would do would be that, and there were also people who are not going to spend a lot of time standing in line to give their votes. They're like Bhadralok. So what they would do is they would make the lines so that those lines are standing right underneath the afternoon sun at 11 or 10. So the heat would be intolerable there. And so they would just essentially wait for those people to just get pissed off by the long line. So they would do something known as booth jamming, where CPM cadres would go in the, you know, they would stand in line early. And then they would go there, the CPM would create objections, or somebody would create objections. They would take time in the front of the line. They would take like 15 minutes, 20 minutes, essentially extending the line further and further into the sun, after which the Bhadralok would get pissed off and just go home, at which point of time their votes would then be cast. So Bengal has had a very long checkered history of, let's say, nefarious voting practices. So it's a very good thing that And this is, again, something, if the BJP ever comes to power, I'm not going to say that it's not that the BJP is not going to do it. So there's no high moral ground here. This was, again, these are tactics which were developed and implemented by the communists in Bengal, and it served them in good stead. So this was what they did in Bhadra areas of Calcutta, in the suburbs where there was less press coverage in those days. Remember, there was no smartphones. So whatever happened a few miles outside Calcutta remained a few miles outside Calcutta. So there they would have like goons on bikes riding around with like red flags, essentially like, whoever comes out to vote, we are watching you. So that kind of very explicit intimidation was there, but these things didn't happen in downtown Calcutta, let's say. They're nothing like this. You wouldn't see anything. Everything would be very implicit, and everybody knew that too. So this is a good move, but I'm digressing. The reason why I wanted to talk about this was this eight-phase thing. It would be good if Vikram was in this podcast. It would be a good topic for having an actual conversation rather than me jabbering about this nonstop. But it reminded me of, in a way, of wedding dinners in Bengal. And I've been thinking a lot of food for the last year. Maybe it's because of COVID and staying at home, but I'm increasingly, and it's also because I'm getting older, that I have started dreaming of food. Food as in not the food that I get here, but like langcha and pantua and sweets. And I wonder why that is the case. So part of it is, of course, that, I'm trying to hearken back to a time in which eating did not have any consequences. It was a consequence-less action. Nowadays, when you get old and you're conscious of other things and you realize that any food that tastes good is essentially poison, you no longer have that unquestioned relationship with food that you had when you were young, because you were innocent, you didn't know what carbs were, and you just basically ate. Nobody knew what carbs were, and you basically ate whatever you got. As long as your parents could afford it, you ate it. Cigarettes, no, I never smoked because everybody knew that was bad. But other than that, I mean, we ate everything. And I kind of find myself in the mid-40s, again, strangely, this is dream. So this is obviously something which is my subconscious, is dreaming about mishti dokan. So, and I've recently started again dreaming about having multiple courses in weddings. And I think this is not so much the food, I believe, but it's in a way I'm thinking that during COVID times, I'm missing human company. I'm just missing being in a crowd. It's not particularly the food, because wedding food was never really that great when we were growing up. I mean, it was fun, but it was never that great. But I think it's more the combination of the food and the company and the chaos that I'm increasingly find myself missing. This is something which I've said before, that as I've grown older, and I don't know if this is just something which is just me or this happens to people, that I generally don't like entertaining people at my house or even going to people's homes, because I just feel awkward. I don't know what to say. I'm always afraid that I'm offending anybody. I'm offending someone. And this is one option, is I stay silent. And if I stay silent, then it's extremely boring. And I just feel that the conversations that people have in face-to-face, and maybe this is my bias, because this is what remembrance is. You always remember the good things and you forget the bad things. But in my parents' time, I think conversations were more interesting. The conversations that people used to have face-to-face were much more interesting. It wasn't about things like, DSLR cameras and, shit stuff, which doesn't matter. People used to talk about their own problems, and people used to gossip. They used to gossip a lot. And, gossip is bad, but it doesn't mean that I don't like it. And I used to, really like it, to enjoy kind of hanging around, those kinds of adult conversations. Not really participating, because I was a good boy. My parents ensured that, I was a good boy And I was not supposed to understand many of the things, which I definitely understood. So I used to kind of hang around and weddings. And I think this is what I'm missing more than the food. I think it's a combination. So all the adults, at least some of them, would, you know, gather around the wooden chairs. And then they would start criticizing and carping, usually about the food at the wedding, you know, gazillion number of things about the people who were getting married, about the parents of the people who were getting married. And it was sometimes subtle, sometimes it was very overt. And there was one thing that I remember, I absolutely absolutely can be perfectly sure that nobody discussed politics in those days. That even these kinds of very personal topics, this very hypercritical, they never really divided people in the way that a Narendra Modi or a Rahul Gandhi does. And I'm amazed as to how divisive these people, you know, it doesn't matter what, you know, what political ideology you believe in, but the fact that politics has come into, you know, friend WhatsApp group, family WhatsApp groups, and I frequently see on Twitter, I have decided to block my parents because, you know, they support BJP. You know, when I see this, I sometimes wonder, why didn't this happen when I was growing up? I mean, the conversations that people were having were far more inflammatory and far more personal than, you know, your opinion on CAA. How does it matter? I mean, if I hear somebody has an opinion on CAA that I don't agree with, how is that going to make me more angry than, you know, somebody passing an opinion on the lifestyle of somebody who I might actually have an emotional attachment to? So and these people matter. They're in our circles, unlike a Modi or a Rahul Gandhi or an Amit Shah, who, as we like to say, wouldn't even bat an eyelid if they see us dying on the street. They would walk right past. So why do we allow ourselves to be so emotionally invested in issues that we have no stake in, which we cannot change, and which in many ways affect us much more peripherally than the topics that in those days people used to discuss? Again, there was no WhatsApp or anything. But I remember this wedding especially, because, you know, people would, and weddings were very frequent. I mean, there'd be 3 or 4 big weddings every year. And they were all from different circles, sometimes from my father's side, sometimes mother's side, sometimes in the locality, sometimes, you know, so of course it would vary depending on, you know, which side of the family and everything. So they, again, that was there. But, you know, people would gather down and they would talk. And then discussion would be about the food. Like, we got in and the coffee was cold. And in those days, you know, when people went in, they were served coffee in what was essentially shot glasses. So, and then in those days, I don't know if this happens too much, but in those days, there were no buffets. You know, people didn't have buffets. The reason why they didn't have buffets was very simple, because if they had buffets, then people would eat all the high value food, that is all the non-veg. And that was something which, of course, people couldn't afford. So these were different days. And I was thinking about all the strange things of those days when I remember my grandmother. I once saw my grandmother had somebody in her neighborhood had invited her to a wedding where in Bengali, there was a word which is says shobandhobe, which means come with your friends. And the person who had given her the wedding card had taken his pen and had crossed it out explicitly. I found that hilarious, that, you know, he was really afraid that my grandmother would actually show up with a huge army of friends. So he actually crossed that shobandhobe out in her invitation. I don't know if this was a privilege for only her or this was something which he did, you know, for every card that he distributed. But there was one thing. And, you know, when I was dreaming, I kept on thinking about these things. I was wondering which of these you would still see. And there was to be like so weddings were all sit down. So dinner was invariably always sit down. And of course, this changed over the years. So even towards the end of the 90s, when I left India, there were some weddings in which there was a hybrid. There were some people could sit down, some people could go to the, you know, have a buffet. And nowadays, when I go to India and I see even the few weddings, now there are like different stations, which one has Chinese and one has, oh my goodness, this was like beyond anything that I'd ever seen growing up. So in those days, by the way, at least in Bengali weddings, in some places, they used to give these menu cards, which were like these, you know, very small card printouts of what the menu was. And, you know, and menu items included things like salt and lemon and, you know, things which you don't normally consider to be an item were included as like, these are the things which you were getting. And somehow, I don't know, maybe it's COVID, but I just totally miss. It's not so much the food, it's the ability to like laugh at those cards. It's to, you know, roll up your eyes and say, oh my goodness, they even have the lemon, the Gondwaraj Lebu is being called out as a menu item, goddammit. And, you know, sitting there and watching the guys and they and you know, people started, the quote unquote caterers started dressing up in white in the mid 90s. I mean, initially it was just people in banyans and lungis with big buckets, which big with big metal buckets, which had the food in them. It was multi-purpose bucket. God knows what else the bucket was used for. And they would be going with these massive ladles and they would be, you know, just essentially right in front of you on the plate. And you would be sitting there and there would be like guests who would essentially be shouting, stop bringing the Radha Ballabhi again and again, because we want the real food. And people would be very vocal about these things. It wasn't that people were just sitting there. There would be always be this one guy who would be very vocal about the fact that, but what about this fish? You know, how many times have you come and given me bony fish? Give me a good piece, goddammit. But there would always used to be, I can't think of one wedding where I've gone to where I haven't seen one of these guys somewhere around. And of course, I wasn't like that. I felt it. I always felt that I was getting the bad piece, but I couldn't articulate that, which means that, you know, this victimhood is kind of built into me. But there's always somebody who was shouting. And again, I kept thinking to myself, these are the kind of things which I miss. It's not so much the food. And again, as I said, my relationship with food has become more complicated over the years. And it's not because definitely of the people. Of course, the gossip and all was entertaining. And I could then, like, once they had gone, I would like kind of mimic each of these guys to myself, you know, how this guy spoke and how that guy spoke, even though they didn't know that I was listening to them. I would always kind of, as I said, hang around the periphery, just observing like an author. But I think what I miss, and this is something which I miss, is the sheer chaos of a Bengali wedding. And the fact that it wasn't all kumbaya peace and, you know, hum aapke hai kaun people, you know, good looking people running around stealing shoes and everybody keeping their temper. No, it was sometimes it was a very, very tense wedding. There was no doubt about it. Even as a kid, I could feel the tension in the air. There's a large number of people, strangers. If something as big as like that, you know, shit happens. And there are people there who are quick to take offense. There are people who are coming with baggage, with history. They're going to meet there. Maybe not going to see each other for the next 3 or 4 years. So this is just a lot of narrative stories. You know, there's a lot of narrative lines which are going through. So obviously, it's never going to be a very peaceful place. But, you know, I used to enjoy that. I did. This wasn't the food. The food's quality wasn't that great. But it was just that way that the food was being served. And, you know, there used to be batches. So since this was buffet, you know, eating was a synchronous event. It wasn't an asynchronous event that you went to the buffet table, had whatever you want, you could eat at your own pace. No, you had to sit at specific times. When the batch finished, the next batch would start. And that would be another cause of, you know, anger and tension as to who gets to sit for the first batches. You know, so there was some person who's apparently going to catch a long distance train and he wasn't seated in one of the first batches. So he got mad and he went home and his brother is now shouting his ass off. And so there was this, the whole notion of batches kind of added one layer of complexity to something which was already extremely complex. And all of this, at least for me, was supremely fun. And years later, when, you know, the ordered, you know, the anodyne life that, you know, I live nowadays, especially with COVID, in terms of like, it's like I go out for grocery shopping and that's it. You know, it's kind of miss, perhaps more than anything else, is the food, but it's also the chaos of essentially being with people, of not really caring about physical distancing or emotional distancing, of there being tension and there being life, but also there being a level of honesty that people nowadays lack. People are nowadays much less willing across the board to express what they actually feel about others. Everybody is solely focused, and I hope that I am not sounding like an old man on a park bench, but they're wholly focused on projecting an aura of success. The only thing they're really scared of is somebody will think that they're a failure, that they're either a failure professionally or a failure as a spouse or failure as a son or failure as a parent. That's really what they care for. When we were growing up, especially during weddings, when you had these kind of community conversations, I don't think anybody was really concerned about, I mean, there were some people who were, of course, trying to show off. But the moment they were trying to show off, somebody would say, you know what, stop showing off. And, you know, people would say that. People wouldn't say, wow, I like that. I love you. You look awesome. People wouldn't say that. So there was this refreshing honesty. And that's the kind of interaction which I really miss, and which is why I don't like interacting in this day and age in real life. Maybe this podcast where I keep on talking and you're obliged to hear this, unless, of course, you close your podcast app. This is perhaps something which I'm more comfortable with, because I know that in a way I'm not at your home. I'm not physically there. And there is no discomfort here. You have the option to listen to me and you have the option not to. I cannot tolerate this almost nursing home sterility of today's conversations. This could be, again, my individual experience. Maybe, and I would love to hear whether my listeners feel that it's the same way with them, or maybe I've just been hanging out with the wrong people. But it's that what I'm missing during this COVID time. The food, definitely, the chaos, definitely. But the fact that you could talk without incident, without being socially canceled. And you didn't need to talk about politics. Nobody talked about politics. Well, maybe the once or twice I've heard politics, but this was already local politics. It was never really, I've never heard, for instance, anybody talking about Operation Blue Star or, you know, Indira Gandhi, or, you know, nobody talked about those things. Nobody talked about whether Indira Gandhi's economic policies is too communist, or whether we should, about Chogam or Nam, or nobody talked about these things. I mean, they would perhaps, you know, some guys may talk a little bit about cricket. Some people might, I mean, fun things. They would talk about maybe movies. They would definitely never talk about politics. There might be some discussions about, well, you know, whether Jyotin Chakraborty should have painted the top of the monument red, or whether Usha Uttup, and whether you were, you know, on Usha Uttup's side and Jyotin Chakraborty's side. And if you're not getting these references, that's fine. But if you were in 80s Bengal, you would know what I'm talking about. So there would be these minor controversies, but nobody really had very strong opinions on this. I mean, people were just, he just wanted to talk about it. And, you know, nobody mattered. Nobody stood up and said, you're a fascist, or you're an urban Naxal, or you're actually being paid by Pakistan, or you're being paid by George Soros. Nobody was saying that. I mean, topics were raised, conversations moved on. And even when gossip was being done, it was done from a perspective of good intentions. I mean, nobody was explicitly saying that you were in bad, you're saying this in bad faith. And sometimes they did. But at least they said it out in the open. And I miss that candor. I miss that organized chaos. And I don't know. What about you? So let me know, because I'm really interested in knowing, for those of you who listen to me, how has your interactions has changed? I mean, when you were a kid and when you used to hang around the periphery listening to adults, do you think that the very nature of person-to-person interaction has changed over the years with social media, with changing culture in India, which we imbibe a lot from the West? Or do you think it's kind of remained the same? It's just that maybe what I'm saying is just a function of the particular path my life has taken, and this is not something which is general to everyone. So I would be interested in hearing from you on this. So send me email, or, you know, send me a tweet and let me know. I'm genuinely interested in knowing. So thanks a lot for listening to this podcast. We've come to the end. For those of you who would like to support the podcast, I have a Patreon page. The link will be in the description. So please do consider signing up for as a monthly contributor. Again, the content of this podcast will always be free. So this is a purely voluntary thing. There is nothing will ever go behind a paywall as it with respect to this podcast. So thanks, everybody. And, have a great week. And we will talk again next week. Bye-bye.